presentation now.
Yes, yes.
Okay. So some of the beginning of this presentation is no change from prior years, so I'm going to go through it quickly, but obviously please let me know if there's any questions. Want to spend most of the time just on the financial information. But as far as the responsibilities, we've conducted our audit in accordance with auditing standards generally accepted in the U.S., and then our goal is to form and express an opinion about whether the financial statements, which we do assist the commission in preparing, however, they are reviewed and approved by management. And then we also, as we are doing tonight, have the board review the draft as well. And we need to make sure that they're materially correct, fairly presented, and conform with accounting principles generally accepted in the U.S. And then I always like to remind everyone that an audit provides reasonable, not absolute assurance that the financial statements do not contain material misstatements due to fraud or error. And what that means is during 2019, we weren't there watching everything. And then when we conduct our audit, we don't test 100% of the transactions. So we're going to do different calculations that allow us to, for, you know, some of the population pull a sample. We don't run into any issues and we feel comfortable, we can kind of move on to other testing. The commission is responsible for its financial statements, all aspects of internal control during the audit, providing us with unrestricted access to anyone we might need to make inquiries of or any supporting documentation we might need to review. If there were any fraud, illegal acts, significant deficiencies, or material weaknesses, making us aware of them, we have not been made aware of any. Subsequent events, so pretty much we are ready to sign off on this. Subsequent events are something that would be January 1, 2020 through the date we sign off. So we have to identify if there's anything that would be meaningful to someone reviewing the financial statements that we might need to disclose. At this point, there's been nothing identified that we would need to disclose. And then essentially all of this that I'm going over tonight is in what's called a management representation letter, and Chief will sign off on that hopefully tomorrow, as long as there aren't any major changes. As far as the audit goes, we are not required and we do not test internal controls, but we are required to understand internal controls. So it'd be difficult for me to properly test your expenses, your revenues, your cash accounts if I didn't know what the procedures were. So, you know, who approves the expenses? How do the bank reconciliations get done? Who reviews them, et cetera? So that's our starting point, is we understand how things are working, and then we essentially identify what areas are of higher risk. And then we develop tests that we perform. And we have to actually switch those tests up every year. We're not allowed to just test the same accounts, the same dollar thresholds every year. We have to have what's called an element of unpredictability. So every year we change it up a little bit. And then, as I said, we don't test everything. So we'll do certain calculations where we identify what's material as far as a dollar amount to the financial statements. And that also helps us in our testing. What dollar amount will we test 100% of? And under that, we would do a sample of the population. As normal, as part of the audit, we had some proposed journal entries or audit adjustments. I'm not going to bring those up tonight unless anyone wants me to bring them up, but essentially, for the most part, I've gone through those with Lisa and Chief, and no issues there, so those will get made in the QuickBooks file, so everything meshes.
Can you give us a broad summary of what categories?
Sure. So for the most part, the journal entries are going to be related to accruals. So accounts receivable at year end, accounts payable at year end, any adjustments to the payroll liabilities at year end, adjustments related to depreciation expense for the year, any changes to the fixed asset additions or deletions of fixed asset items. I think, not having them in front of me, but I think there might have been some just classification changes, but for the most part, it's those year-end type of entries.
Thank
so
you.
As far as the audit results, unmodified opinion, clean opinion, two thumbs up, no change from prior year. And so obviously, you know, we didn't sign off on it yet, but we've got an unmodified opinion on it. So as far as financial information, so what I have here is a look at the budget versus the actual for 2019. So as you can see in the left-hand column, we've got the budget, middle is actual, and then a variance on the right-hand side. So you can see as far as the revenue piece at the top, and I've highlighted a couple items here just to kind of help point them out, intergovernmental revenues were under budget by about $85,000. but pension state aid was over by 107,000. So those kind of even themselves out, because essentially the $85,000 that did not come in from the municipalities actually did come in, but there was additional state aid that came in. So there were pension refunds that went back to both Springettsbury and Manchester Township. So your municipal payments are budgeted, and that's what are paid quarterly. But in this case, and in prior years, there's always been a little bit of difference in the amount that's paid by the townships, except for Spring Garden, for pension. And so the actual then, any difference then gets paid back to those municipalities. So that's really the difference there. They kind of even themselves out. As far as total revenues, pretty consistent with the budget, came in about $31,000 over budget. Again, most of that uptick there was in the pension state aid and a couple other revenues. But revenue-wise, things came in pretty well on budget as expected. When we drop down to...
Chris, yeah? The top-line revenues, why did that not get to budget?
The intergovernmental revenues?
Yes, the top line.
So the money actually came in, but the amount of pension that ended up being owed by Springettsbury and Manchester was lower than what was expected because you got additional state aid. So the money actually did come in, but essentially it was an overpayment and then refunded. And those amounts are actually included in accounts payable at 12/31/19, and they were subsequently paid in 2020.
Thank Krista, you. A follow-up question to that is,
sure.
Does that intergovernmental revenues include any grant funding, or is it only exclusively the member municipalities?
That is exclusively the member municipalities. The grant funding is under that federal and state grants. And there might be some local money in that other revenues line item, but that is strictly the budgeted amounts from municipalities.
So another way to look at this, there's really no material change in the amount of grant funding that this fire company receives.
Correct. And Chief, that usually, unless there's something special that comes through, your grants are pretty consistent from year to year.
Correct. In fact, what you're showing there is state grant from the Office of the State Fire Commissioner. We apply regularly to the federal government under the Assistance to Firefighters Grant program. But it's been several years since we received a federal grant. Those are highly competitive.
Any other questions on revenue?
That's all I have at the moment.
All right. So then we'll jump down into operating expenses. So top line, biggest line is personnel services. And this one jumped out as, you know, quite the difference from budget versus actual, coming in about $761,000 under budget. And I'm, Chief, please jump in here. We've had the discussion. We actually included in the management's discussion and analysis in the financial statement a new blurb on this year, because there was such a difference there, budget versus actual. I said to Lisa and Chief when we were reviewing the draft, I said, I really think for the reader, it would be good to go ahead and include something as far as why there was such a variance here. So kind of the main areas revolved around when the 2019 budget was being developed. So remember, you're 3 to 6 months prior to 2019. Everyone was in negotiations as far as being hopeful to come under one contract. So there were salary increases related to that. Retirements that happened in 19 that had a significant impact on not only the salaries for those firefighters, but also the additional related benefits. So those were really the main two drivers as far as why we saw such a variance in the budget versus actual for 2019 for those personnel services. Chief, did you want to jump in any more on that?
I think you hit it. I mean, the bottom line was, when we did the budget for 19, it would have been in July and August of 18. We were anticipating getting to one contract, a singular wage scale with all the employees, and that just didn't happen. So I think the number we came up with was that would have equaled about a 10% increase.
Yep.
One of the things that we have to take into consideration too is with just normal attrition, our employees aren't in the habit of notifying us 6 months out or more of their intentions. Usually the first indicator that somebody plans on retiring in the coming year is when we get their vacation picks in December and see how they're front loading stuff. That usually gives us an indication, but that usually they hold on to that information till it's much closer, just in case something would change. They don't want to end up retiring before they're ready. So I know it looks like a big chunk of money, but when you really look at what we experienced first with negotiations and then the amount of turnover that we had, it's the difference also with the health benefits going from family coverage to single coverage, it's really not unexpected.
And just for reference, it's page 10 of the financial statements where we actually added, it's a whole section called budgetary highlights, and we added three paragraphs in there in regards to this variance between budget and actual for 2019. Any questions there? That's kind of, as far as kind of like the big item from, you know, the audit as far as variance, that's really the big area. Expenses, as you'll see, materials and supplies, other operating expenses, some of those items are going to be up and down from year to year. To be honest, individual line items were all comparable from year to year, nothing significant. It really truly wasn't everything personnel or payroll related that we saw the significant variances this year. And then also in the expenses, just to kind of point out here, your depreciation expense. Yeah. Oh, there we go. Depreciation expense, you never budget for that. You budget on a purely cash basis. So it's not unusual to show the fact that there's a zero budget and then the actual number came in. Because remember, per GAAP, we have to be accrual basis here. So although it shows us that variance, that's been the practice. You don't budget for depreciation since your cash basis. So in total, your operating expenses came in under budget, about $380,000. And then operating wise, you had an excess of revenues of about $213,000. Now these are just operating revenues and expenses. On the next slide, we do have some non-operating activity, but that's the operating piece. Any questions there before I move forward?
Proceed.
Okay. So then this slide, non-operating revenues, you'll see that top line item, that's the capital contributions. So if you actually look at your budget, you've got two budgets. You have your operating budget and you've got your capital budget. We mesh them together because on your financial statements, all of the activities together. So we go ahead and we bring over that capital contributions piece because you do budget for it and you received exactly what you budgeted for because that's what the municipalities are invoiced for. Refund of prior expenses, for the most part, that's going to be either workers' comp or the health insurance co-op reimbursements. That's going to depend on the year, but to be honest, pretty darn close there, coming in about $35,000 over. Sale of fixed assets, you don't usually, again, just because you're not quite sure at that time when you're budgeting, you don't usually budget for sale of fixed assets. Some interest income. The interest income was up because our cash balance was up, which we'll get to that in a couple of slides here. And then that last piece is refund of excess fund balance. Now, one note I'd like to point out here for discussion is we changed the verbiage last year from refund of excess fund balance to refund of excess cash. And I have that calculation to go over with you, but I am proposing that we do change the line item on the financial statements to say refund of excess cash, because essentially we're no longer calling it refund of excess fund balance. So that is one change as far as wording on the financial statements that I would propose. So pausing on that, we at this point have booked a return of excess cash of about $452,000. We'll get to that calculation. But essentially, the end result accrual basis for the commission is a positive $465,000, a change in fund balance of $465,000, which takes the net position to a positive $362,000 at the end of 2019. But again, that $362,000 number is accrual basis, so you have depreciation in there, other non-cash type items. So what I'd like to do then is I'm going to fast forward here. I'm going to skip this. I'm going to go to the calculation of excess cash. So this is our second year essentially taking this approach where, remember, 2 years ago we zeroed things out because of Manchester Township joining. And now what we do is we take the total of the cash accounts at December 31, 2019, which was $1,156,000. We do not include the capital reserve account. It's just the operating accounts. We then add accounts receivable at year end, amounts due from other governments, and then prepaid expenses, essentially giving ourselves credit for amounts that we've already paid or essentially will receive. We then subtract accounts payable at 12/31/19, accrued wages, and then our current portion of compensated absences. So those leave balances that we know will be paid out in the next year, that current portion 2020. That gets us to what we consider our estimated cash position of $783,522. The policy then states that the commission can keep 3 to 5% of the next year's budgeted expenses. So in the past, historically, the commission has kept 4%. So total budgeted expenses for 2020 were about $8.3 million. 4% of that is $331,540, and that's where we get to what we're essentially calling excess cash at 12/31/19 of the $451,982. So what then happens with that excess portion is that cash isn't given back to the municipalities, but it is credited to their third and fourth quarter billings in 2020. And as you can see there, the percentages are listed as far as how that split out. And then Springettsbury, for instance, 167,233, divide that by two, and that amount would be the credit on the third quarter billing and the fourth quarter billing for 2020. Just threw a lot at you. Same approach as last year. Again, you know, when I kind of did the first initial calculation after we had the entries in, I said to Chief, we've got quite an excess balance here. Let's talk about how we got to the cash position, and that kind of circles back with, okay, our budgeted expenses, we ended up having our salaries come in quite a bit under what was budgeted, and that kind of correlates to this increased cash position when we compare ourselves to the end of 2018.
Krista, before you leave this slide,
sure.
tell me again how you calculated the current portion of compensated absences.
Those are sick leave balances, sick leave, right, Chief? Yes, sick leave balances that we know have already been paid out in 2020, or we know will be, but I think at this point it's all that we know have already been paid out in 2020. So it's essentially we've got one big leave balance that's on the financials as a liability, but anything that's determined to be paid in the next 12 months is considered that current portion.
Okay.
So that's why we've included that. Any other thoughts or questions? Chief, anything else you want to throw in there?
No, I don't believe so. I think you've hit everything we've been discussing. So
I will compliment you, Krista. This slide is the best explanation of this I have ever seen. We have done this for how many years? And it's always kind of fluffy.
It's hard. Well, and that's where when we switched over, and I say we, you switched over to looking at it as excess cash instead of fund balance made a lot more sense. If you also remember, we are always like 2 years behind when we were taking it from the fund balance approach. So this has kind of sped us up to real time where we're looking at, 6 months ago at 12/31. And also in the past, there was physical money that was handed back. And that's where we kind of said, and working with Steve last year when we switched all of this over and said, you know, it really doesn't make sense to kind of hand that cash back. Let's credit it against those upcoming payments.
The true test of this policy is if we have less than 3%.
And that's actually, if you remember, we ended up there last year. So at the end of 2018, there technically wasn't what's considered excess cash, but it had already been credited. And that's where the discussion last year was, we're going to leave it as is. We're okay with the fact that we gave a credit for those first two quarters. Again, because we were still in that transition of being more real time. But you can see here the direct impact those budgeted items have on the cash, because this organization is operating in the sense that here's our budget, and really, you know, if it lines up with the cash, we shouldn't have a lot of excess on hand at end of the year.
Yes, this is a perfect systemization of our philosophy. I'm very impressed.
Good. Any other questions or thoughts on this? And again, like I said, when Chief and Lisa and I talked, you know, they kept it at the 4% because that's kind of what has historically worked, keeping 4%, although the policy says 3 to 5.
Just as Charles, just to understand some of the changes in the balance sheet accounts, it's just the mere collection of some of those receivables and also the payout of the payables in a pure cash approach.
Exactly.
The delta of those balance sheets from an accrual standpoint.
Exactly, because essentially, as we know, some things that are received in 2020 or paid in 2020 are truly related to 2019. So we want to make sure the cash that was collected during the year is able to be used for those items. So that's where we essentially come to this, what we're calling estimated cash position. Is it ever going to be 100% correct? No, but when we came up with kind of this philosophy in preparing for 2018, this made the most sense and got us as close as possible.
So the payback or the credits to the various municipalities, those are real hard and fast numbers.
That is correct. Yep. So, and I'm going to go ahead and go back to the slide we were on. That 451,982 in that kind of greenish line, we have booked a payable at 12/31/19 for that excess return. So as you can see here, it shows as a non-operating expense. It's in AP, or it's actually in due to members at 12/31/19. And Lisa's actually waiting for this meeting tonight to go ahead and for the third quarter invoice, credit half of that amount, and then the other half would be credited against the fourth quarter of 2020's invoice. So at the end of the day, the revenues for 2020 will still show what was budgeted for 2020 because this impact is against 2019. But cash-wise, you're just sending in the net amount as opposed to cash being returned and then you making your normal payment. We just put it into one transaction.
Understood. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Any other questions there? So the two slides that I kind of skipped in the middle there was I just provided a trend analysis. And this document will be finalized with probably tomorrow's date. So this whole presentation will be sent to all of you so you will have it. But again, this kind of just takes a trend analysis as far as where the past 5 years ago. Again, on the first slide, it's all operating. I'm looking at the operating revenues and expenses. And then on the second slide, I have non-operating. You'll see the big jump from 2017 to 2018 when Manchester Township joined the commission. So it's always just kind of good to have some perspective as far as where things have come, just to kind of take that in as far as where things are going in the future. And again, the same thing with this slide, just on the non-operating piece. Any other questions on the numbers? All right, so the only other real thing related to the financial statements that I did want to highlight is behind your normal financial statements, there's also the statement of fiduciary position. And the fiduciary funds of the commission are your pension plans. And so they're still reported because essentially they are the commission's plans, but that money is not the commission's to spend. So that's essentially what considers them a fiduciary fund. Well, Government Accounting Standards Board, they always have, you know, new pronouncements that come out. And GASB 84 essentially redefined what it meant to be a fiduciary fund. And the very high level explanation of this is the organization not only has to have control of the assets, also has to kind of be the decision maker related to the assets. So what happened here is your defined benefit plan still shows as a fiduciary fund of the commission because it is the township's plan and you're the decision-making body as far as what happens with those investments. But all of the defined contribution plans are now no longer considered fiduciary funds of the commission. And that's because with a defined contribution plan, essentially we define what we're contributing to that plan, and then the owners of the plan, which are the individual employees, they have decision-making ability as far as how those funds are invested. So what GASB 84 has said is they are actually no longer considered fiduciary funds. So you will see, I just copied this from note N of the financial statements, but the fiduciary net position does have a prior period adjustment that actually we took back to 1/1/2018, because your statements are comparative 2 years, where we've removed the defined contribution plans. So it's only the defined benefit plan that's reported. In the footnotes, though, we still do note that you have the defined contribution plans and have some information about them. So that way, if someone was reading your statements, they would know that there are those other plans. They're just not reported in the financials anymore.
And do I understand that that number is shown on page 16 of the full report, roughly $2.3 million?
Yes, so $2.3 million essentially was the asset balance of all of the defined contribution plans. So to restate January 1, 2018, that amount came out of the investments of the fiduciary funds and therefore also came out of the net position of the fiduciary funds.
Got it.
Any other questions there?
Krista, one other, could you walk me through again why GASB 84 then? Why do they take those things off balance sheet?
Well, that's a whole question sometimes as far as why GASB does the things that it does. But to be honest, I understand in the sense that, so although the plan, a defined contribution plan, is kind of under the commission's umbrella, or you'll hear me talk about this same thing next week at the Springsbury Township meeting, where the township has a defined contribution plan that's under its umbrella. The township, though, or in this case the commission, does not have control over those assets. They are, you know, employee XYZ's assets as soon as they're contributed to the plan. Whereas opposed to with a defined benefit, you've got the control as far as how things are invested, and essentially you've got a continued commitment to essentially fund that plan.
Okay, thank you. I'll save you a question for next week.
It's okay. We'll see if my answer is consistent.
Chris, I have a question on page 27 of the report. Talk about the net pension liability, and it looks like it dropped by about $1 million.
It sure did. Yes.
Can you tell the main driver behind that decrease?
Your investments in that plan did incredibly well in 2019. And this has been a topic of discussion at our firm recently with not only our municipalities, but our upcoming school district audits, where you've got pension plans that are, just kind of all over the board. And if you think about it, you know, your plan is using a 6.5% discount rate. And if you think about, and that's all based on investment return. But if you think about, you know, where the economy is right now, we think, wow, how can we be using a 6.5% discount rate? But that's because we have to think about this as long term. So this is the life of the plan and not just right now. A lot of municipalities are actually at the 7% level as far as discount rate and what the expected return on investments are. A lot of municipalities are making their way down to 6.5. So you're actually already at 6.5. I had a conversation with Conrad Siegel on this. It all just depends on the investments. Who knows? This time next year, we very well likely could see a swing the exact opposite way, where we're increasing that net pension liability $1 million. Changes in assumptions will also go into that, and obviously who's in the plan as far as calculations. Mortality rates, that's, one of the assumptions that the actuaries will use. You know, we're seeing people live longer and longer, so that creates a higher and higher pension liability when we've got these defined benefit plans. But for the most part, that line item, that change was mostly driven by your investment earnings for 2019.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Anything else? So I just have a couple of quick slides here. The next couple of slides really are just our standard language. We've complied with all ethics other than that GASB 84 fiduciary fund change. There was no change to the accounting policies, how things are recorded, et cetera. Estimates always go into the financial statements. There are no difficulties, no disagreements. That date will be updated when I send the rep letter to Chief tomorrow. And pretty much everything that I'm required to disclose to those charged with governance or the board, I've included this evening. So then the last item is internal control. As I stated, we are not required to test internal controls, but if we are aware of a deficiency that is at a material weakness or a significant deficiency level, I am required to communicate that to the board. There is one material weakness. This is no change from prior years, and this is just the fact that the commission relies on the auditing firm to prepare the financial statements. Now, I say prepare, we always label it as we assist in preparing the statements because essentially everything's given to us. But again, we make sure that we review everything significant with Chief and with Lisa, and then also go over a draft with you as the board for review. And that's just because of independence reasons. We have to make sure that we can kind of document all of that. In a perfect world, if we're doing an audit, we would walk in the door, and not only would you hand over kind of the trial balancing, the account detail, but you would also hand over the financial statements. But we know in government world that often does not happen. And so it's okay that we assist in preparing those financial statements. We just have to disclose that.
So, Krista, for us to eliminate this note, we would need a CFO-level person on staff?
Well, not necessarily a CFO-level person, but I think in most cases that's the level you're going to find, a CPA, someone that's going to keep up with, oh, GASB 84 comes into effect this year, and GASB such and such comes into effect next year, and can essentially do the majority of those financial statements.
And of your other municipal clients, roughly what size budget, operating budget, do you start to see that level of employee?
I only have, in the government world, I have a school district that prepares most of their financial statements. I don't have any other government clients that prepare their financials.
School district's in the $30 million budget range?
More than that. Okay. Yeah, more than that.
All right.
So that's all I have. Obviously, if there are any questions on the actual financial statements, you know, please let me know. You'll get, like the presentation, like I said, we'll get the finalized financial statements out to everyone. But if there's any, you know, we're going to go ahead and move forward with signing off tomorrow, unless for any reason you'd like us to hold off for any reason.
So, Krista, in your opening paragraph in the audit report, you say one of the most important questions asked by the commission's finances is the commission as a whole better off or worse than it was a year ago? How would you answer that? Are we better off, or did we just and from a business standpoint, to me, it looks like if we over, if we budget too high, we look like heroes.
So I'll equate this to, at this point, this is the first year we've seen a significant variance like this in budgeting. I used to work with a school district where every year we were seeing significant, the budget was just significantly off, to the point where we actually had internal control deficiencies because there was a huge disconnect there. And that was one thing, and we didn't get into it this evening, but when I met with Lisa and Chief and I said, okay, here are where our variances are. Let's talk through why, what happened. And I said, it would be a good idea to take a look at 2020. And, you know, about halfway through, or we were probably in April, May when we were talking about it, but, you know, a couple months in, do we think we're going to end up in the same position, or do we think we're going to be more closer to budget? Because I said, if we think we're going to end up in the same position, it's probably good to start talking about that now. And I think, Chief, if I remember correctly, you and Lisa took a look at things, you looked at salaries, you looked at benefits, and felt a lot better as far as coming in more consistent with budget and not kind of having a repeat year there, correct?
We do, largely as far as the attrition is concerned with personnel, but by the same token, we still have a contract that is unresolved. And that, my last conversation with our labor attorney, that could come to, you know, we could get that resolved in the fall, or with this whole pandemic thing, that might get pushed off into 2021. So I do feel better about it just from the attrition standpoint, but we still have that lingering negotiation thing if we don't get it resolved this year, we're liable to see some disparity again for next year's audit. Although I don't think it would be quite as much as we saw with last year's.
Right. And a lot of times when, you know, we're looking at, I'll say kind of a health check on a governmental client, a lot of times it's cash flow. So in this case, you know, obviously there were additional cash flows this year. So from a cash position, you know, did well from that standpoint. Like I said, as far as expenses, really your major variances were all personnel related, and we kind of tied them back to the contract and then those five retirements that happened. Everything else was pretty consistent across the board, no major changes. Obviously repairs, those kind of things, you know, depend on the year. Your revenues are pretty static. We talked about grants a little bit. EMS revenue, you know, that's almost gone. There's not, I think there was like 11 or 12,000 this year. So your revenues are pretty well known. So the expenses are really the only area where there's a lot of wiggle room.
Krista, with your understanding of our situation, our finances, and other municipalities' finances, if you were asked the question to justify EOFR's existence versus three individual municipal fire departments, how would you approach that quantifiably?
I think it all relates to operating efficiency. You've got repeat costs. Equipment is the big thing. Think about all, you know, the major expenses other than personnel. Equipment, so anywhere you can, you know, find efficiencies as far as cutting costs where you've got shared items. Obviously, it's you know, helpful. It's been working for the three municipalities. That's what it comes down to. It comes down to resources and money.
Yeah, and I won't get up on my soapbox, but if you remember, prior to EOFR, there was a significant revenue inflow from the volunteer fire departments that has since dwindled to less.
Yes.
So it's hard to compare a trend line.
It is, and I definitely still see, I work with a couple of fire companies and a smaller one. They're in the process of a merger right now. So I think it's the continued approach. And again, if we can come together and utilize resources and money and, you know, kind of make it, you know, go a little farther or last a little longer. Why not? Especially when we're dealing with taxpayer dollars. It's all about being fiscally responsible.
Fantastic presentation. This is.
Thank you. Thank you.
Very well done. Any questions for Krista?
Krista, so, I have a follow-up question, if I may. Sure. I've got a motorcycle in the background. Sorry.
That's okay.
To kind of build a little bit on some of the answers to that last question, I wanted to know, as you see other fire companies, are you seeing right now any sources for additional grant monies or ways that we could be more competitive or aggressive in pursuing some additional grant revenues, particularly in this COVID-19 era that we're in?
Yeah, I think Chief said it. A lot of those grant funds are pretty competitive. And as the only other source you truly see fire companies really going after is your contributions, fundraising. And I mean, I know fire companies that bring in 100,000 plus fundraising, but it's an undertaking. And sometimes then I'm having the conversation where I'm saying, okay, it costs you X to bring in Y. Does that make sense? I think, you know, state aid is state aid. You've got your municipal contributions. Those are really where it's going to continue to come in. And then depending on what programs the state has, I don't think there's a lot of room for additional revenue there. Hopefully I'm answering that question, correctly, but I don't see anyone else doing anything significantly different other than everyone handles fundraising differently.
Anything else for Krista? And Krista or Chief or Steve, are we going to acknowledge receipt or are we going to authorize Chief to sign, accept the audit report, or what legislative action are you asking for now?
Typically just acknowledge receipt at this point.
Mr. Chairman, I move to acknowledge the receipt of the 2019 audit report as prepared by Stan Von Ness.
I'll second that.
Moved and seconded. Jean, if you could call for a roll call vote.
Okay, let me get my list. All right, Mr. Hunt?
Yes.
Mr. Rooney?
Yes.
Ms. Wingert?
Aye.
Mr. Worcester?
Aye.
Mr. Inch?
Aye.
Mr. Dvoriak?
Aye.
And I think that's all I have.
All right, motion passes.
Very,
mm-hmm. Very nice, Krista. I mean it. That was the best, most concise cash refund presentation I've ever seen.
All right. Well, now the bar's set high. I got to figure out something new for next year. Make it even better. I think I've stopped sharing my screen, so I think we're all good there, Chief, right?
I think we're good. Thank you very
Perfect.
Much.
Perfect. Thank you much. See you all later.
Thank you. All right. The next item on the agenda is management report. Solicitor Havas.
I have nothing to add unless there are any questions from any of the commissioner members.
Any questions for Steve?
No.
Well, thank you. Chief Hoff, tell us what's going on.
Just a couple items to follow up on from my report. You might remember from last month, we put together a letter to the business community offering our assistance as they try to navigate through the reopening and the change in how they do business. We have entertained a number of businesses out of the three townships that have reached out to us for advice on how they can comply with the code, the fire code and you know, as far as exits and means of egress and blocking exits and blocking off fire extinguishers or blocking off their sprinkler heads. So it's been received very well. So we're real happy with that.
The old ladder truck that we loaned to York Township, we did get a letter signed from them agreeing to take full responsibility for anything that happened while it was in their care. And 2 days after that was signed, they had a mishap with it. So it's being repaired right now, 100% on their tab. So it was a good thing that we had that letter signed. You know, Ms. Hunt there and whoever else was of that opinion. I also wanted to follow up a little bit on Mr. Wooster's questions about the grant.
Actually, Gene, you may want to circle that in the minutes. It looks like Steve logged off, so he didn't hear the compliment.
Okay.
Anyway, as far as the grants go, typically the owner, every once in a while, some corporations offer mini grants to the fire departments. Typically, they lump them all together as career, with both career and volunteer competing for the same ones. So from a career or a combination standpoint that's municipally funded, it's very hard to show the financial need compared to somebody that meets their budget by having chicken barbecues and bingos. This year, with COVID-19, we already had a grant application in for replacement of all our self-contained breathing apparatus. That's probably close to $500,000 grant application till we get everything done. There is a match to that. And it wasn't budgeted for this year because they won't even award it till next year. And even if they would speed things up, which the federal government never does, the performance period for that gets us into next year, so we can take a look at that then. But what they did do is they reopened that application for the opportunity for all fire departments to submit a supplemental COVID-19 grant to cover the costs of our response. We have applied for that, as well on the state level, the Office of the State Fire Commissioner, through their COVID relief funds, is basically anybody that received a state grant for this year, they're getting another check for the same amount of money to handle the costs associated with the pandemic. So we normally get that money anyway, and so we're waiting on another check from the State Fire Commissioner's office for roughly $11,600 or whatever it was, a little over $11,000 that our grant was this year.
So without any justification,
application. If they have an application on file for you, and there's no problem or no history with previous applications, the intelligence we got was they're cutting the check.
And Elisa, we're getting a lot of wind feedback from your.
Oh, sorry about that.
No worries.
I have a question before I mute it for the chief. The money you're getting back, is that, because I had notified Tim and PCERTS, I guess it was Friday, that they said contact your county for any COVID expenses, such as signage. Have you given Tim a list of anything?
No, actually, I'm glad you brought that up. That was going to be the next thing I mentioned.
Oh, sorry about that.
No, that's okay. Yeah, the counties are able to, through that additional funding, I just got an email on it today regarding block grants to cover COVID-19 expenses. Right now I'm trying to find out if we need, as a department, as a regional department, if we need to apply for that through the separate municipalities. Since my understanding is that the county is the one that is collecting the information and going to be administering it, I actually have an email into President Commissioner Wheeler to find out if she will accept our own letter or if we need to split that up and try to get it through the individual townships. So I just sent that email this afternoon, so I'm waiting to hear from her. We actually are working right now on a grant with through FM Global for fire prevention efforts, and we also submitted. Hold on, I gotta let Steve back in. There we go. I also submitted the department submitted a grant application under the Staffing for Adequate Fire and Emergency Response Grant. It's another federal grant program for volunteer recruitment and retention, so we can try to do a better job of attracting and keeping volunteers in this combination department. And that's a 4 or 5 year performance grant. Total value on that is in excess of $100,000.
And when you say a performance grant, what does that mean?
I mean, the performance period, it's not just a single year performance. Because they realize you can't necessarily measure an increase in volunteerism in such a short amount of time. So you have 4 years. I'm sorry.
And what are they measuring? What KPIs are they looking at?
That will come if we're awarded the grant. Right now we just put in for the materials, and I have the notes here. There's items in the area of, length of service and recognition. There's items in signage and advertisement, print marketing, media marketing, they actually even will help cover the cost of whoever we currently have on staff that is tasked as a volunteer coordinator. We can actually claim up to $600 a month for their salary specific to volunteer coordination. So that was just submitted at the end of March. So they haven't even begun to start assessing those applications yet.
And remind us who is which battalion chief or which career employee is currently volunteer retention?
Right now, we don't have one specific one. When it comes to training, Chief Graham's a training officer, so he deals with the new volunteers coming in, helping them get acclimated to training. Chief Arnold takes care of he's the liaison to the fire police. Okay. So each one of them kind of takes a chunk. If this grant were to come to fruition, we would have to maybe take a look at that and designate one person, at least for the record keeping as who the coordinator.
As a fire professional, do you measure volunteer contribution to the fire service?
Well, it's funny because my opinion differs from ISO. ISO comes in and says in order to get credit for a volunteer, they basically need to be on the apparatus responding. And if they're a volunteer that shows up in their personal vehicle, ISO only gives them half credit for that. The state fire commissioner, his office takes active volunteerism, basically to mean anybody that has their hazmat operations training and contributes to the department either in an administrative or an operational standpoint. Since we don't get involved with the volunteer administrations, other than basically attending meetings and being the voice of Yoffer there, we really have to look at what our ultimate goal is, and our ultimate goal is emergency response. So for me, it's getting people trained, getting them on the apparatus, and getting them on the apparatus or at least on the incident scene consistently. And that's proven to be a challenge. 180 hours is what it takes to get them ready to even test for firefighter one. Not a lot of people have that kind of time that are working one or two jobs and have families and so on. So I'm really looking forward to this grant. I think it's going to give us a lot of opportunity to hit different groups, different locations, and really help us spearhead a true recruitment campaign.
Is that something you think we should start measuring and looking at, defining what to measure and start measuring it?
Absolutely. I mean, we've taken a look already. What we've taken a look at already is the decline in volunteer responses to emergencies over the last 5 years. And we've seen a serious decline in that. Keep in mind that the volunteers that we do have in each of our volunteer companies, by and large, are not operational either because of other commitments or because we have an aging volunteer population. It's tough getting new people in. Grantley has historically been the place where they've come into the fire department, you know, through a lot of times through the college. We're seeing less and less of that. And if they do come in, they gravitate towards EMS. Not that EMS isn't important, but there's only so many people you can put on an ambulance. We're always at a shortage of people on the fire scene. So I absolutely think we need to, and that's one of the things we're looking at right now too with the accreditation process is we are not doing the best we can do with recruitment and retention. And that's one of the things that we're going to be challenged to do through accreditation is figure that out.
Chief, just circling back, is there anything that this commission or its members can do to help you advance or advocate for any of those grant applications you have going?
If I'm aware of something, I will absolutely ask. But in most cases, probably the best thing we can do the next time around for the federal grants is probably lobby our local representatives for letters of support. That never hurts with the federal grants. But honestly, the state grant is really, I hate to say it, it's a gimme. You know, if you fill out the paperwork and you're going to get it. And the state fire commissioners made no secret of that, that if you're reporting to the state, you know, with your incident reports the way you should, and you fill out the application, you're getting money. So that is the one application that is not competitive. It's almost a slam dunk every year. It might change, you know, a couple hundred dollars here or there, as far as what you're going to get, but you're going to get the money. But federal grants, absolutely. I think when we're next up for a submission, I think maybe it's one thing we've really never done is gone after support from our legislature, and maybe it's time to do that.
Yeah, it may be the time, but you're the expert as to the grant opportunities before us. But I'm always happy to reach out to our congressman if you ever need it.
I appreciate that. Other than that, unless you have any other questions on my report, that's all I had to cover.
Were you going to talk about the collection service?
We actually have that up down under new business.
Okay.
Oh, Chief, I do have another question circling back to something that you led with. Now that we've reached out to those businesses, and I'm just spitballing here, but is now maybe a time that we've provided some value to the businesses on their reopening? Is it worth it maybe just to print a fundraising letter to those various businesses asking for donations? I don't know if the cost economics are there, but just throwing it out there.
Well, yeah, it's funny you say that. I mean, we've had the discussion here even from not just contacting the businesses from the standpoint of getting out and doing our pre-planning. And the direction I've given our staff so far is that I didn't even want them contacting the businesses. You know, we offered to help them in their restart. I didn't even want us contacting the businesses to schedule pre-plans or site surveys for a little while yet. because I didn't think it was fair to the businesses as they're trying to navigate a new normal to, you know, they're still trying to figure that out. Next thing you know, you got firemen showing up and wanting this or wanting that. Of course, I did tell them, hey, you know, we go to the big box stores. They don't seem like they were hurt much here. So, if we want to ask them for some money, I'm okay with that. But, some of those other businesses, I'd have a real tough time knowing how, you know, what some of these people have been through, asking them for any handouts at this point. But it's absolutely always, it's always in my head. It's just timing.
Yeah. I was thinking the exact same thing. I was thinking more along the lines that bigger stores might be more appreciative.
Yeah.
And more open to it.
And honestly, even throughout all this, you know, when it comes to, you know, just simple stuff like saw blade replacements or some small hand tools or stuff like that, even through the COVID pandemic, Home Depot and Lowe's have continued to be terrific with us. Sam's Club has been terrific with us, you know, for the things we need there. So we've got good relationships, but that's kind of where I've drawn the line. I really don't want to be a pest to somebody that's trying to navigate this.
Absolutely.
Chief, did you want to expound a little bit on your gentle finger wag about auto forwarding emails?
When we set this up and that was more for information, because the firefighters have the Office 365 accounts too. We had started getting some notices that people were auto forwarding their Yoffer email to other accounts. And that created the exact situation we didn't want, which was compromising other accounts, whether they were business or whether they were personal, mixing them up. And kind of the guidance that we put out to by word of mouth to some of our people was, you know, if you've got an iPhone and you're checking your email on your iPhone, you can still get everything to, you know, to view on there, even if it's a separate account. You don't have to auto forward it. But we just felt like that was compromising the whole purpose of us giving employees as well as the commission that dedicated email for y'all for business. And again, don't want to see a situation come up where somebody's personal email or their business email is also compromised through a right to know request because of the auto forwarding issue. I'm not sure if I didn't really have the discussion with Steve. I don't know if he might want to chime in further on that or not.
I really don't have that much to add, Chief. So, you know, sorry I can't be that much of a help.
That's okay. Yeah, we're just trying to make sure our communications are protected. That's it in a nutshell.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
And it is in one of your supporting reports, your activity log, but I did want to compliment you. Your response to arrival time has continually trended downward, shorter. So I don't know if you're eating lunch at places closer to the fire or what, but it statistically you are improving your performance, and I think the guys should be complimented.
They are doing a good job. Now, I think, to be fair, I think we have to keep in mind, too, that for the last for the months of April and May, they were pretty much locked down. So, you know, they came to work. They were training in the station. They weren't going out to do pre-plans. They weren't going out to do any training outside of the station so that we were maintaining that responsible social distancing. So when they finally got a call, they couldn't wait to get out the door.
Well, that's your
it's like, you know, it's like opening the door to your dog. You know, they wanted to get out and run. So, but no, they are doing a great job.
Shut up and take the compliment. Statistically, there is a long-term positive trend.
Yeah, we are proud of them.
Anything else for the chief before we move on? Nice report, Chief. Thank you.
Thank you.
In your packet this evening were the accounts payable listings from the end of May to be reviewed. Any questions or comments before we approve them?
I'll move to approve the accounts payable listing as of May 31st, 2020.
Second. Second, Matt. Sorry.
I'm not sure who unmuted first, Gene.
I defer to Lisa Winger for the second.
Okay.
Roll call vote, please, Gene.
Okay, Mr. Hunt?
Yes.
Mr. Rooney?
Yes.
Ms. Winger?
Aye.
Mr. Worcester?
Aye.
Mr. Inch?
Looks like somehow his connection got lost.
Okay, and Mr. Dvorak?
Aye.
Okay, the motion would be carried.
Thank you. We have no bids, proposals, or contracts. Communications from commissioners. Anything from the other squares in the Brady Bunch screen?
All I want to say is I think the firefighters have been doing a wonderful job at fighting all these fires. So there have been a lot. I don't know if you read his report, but quite, I think more than normal.
Yeah, we definitely saw an uptick.
Yes.
Yeah.
A lot more, especially house fires of lately.
Any theory behind that, or it's just a blip?
The ones that we've had in I can only speak to the ones that we've had in our first due area, not the ones we've assisted on. So far, they've been accidental. We did have a fire at the Motel 6 next to the hop. Although we were able to look at security cameras and find the gentleman that was responsible for starting it, it was still an accidental fire. It was due to smoking materials. It was nice to be able to at least, you know, so often somebody will tell us, well, no, nobody smokes around here when there's cigarette butts laying all over the mulch. And it was nice to be able to go to the camera and actually see what started it and know definitely that there wasn't anything malicious about it. Most of them that we've encountered have been accidental. I don't know if people are getting a little bit more careless or what, but they've been accidental.
Anything else for the chief or any other comments from the commissioners? Paul, I just realized what's behind you. That's a drawing of the USS Enterprise, isn't it?
It is. My kids decided I needed that, being a Star Trek fan of some length.
That's pretty neat. Anything you want to tell us about in the volunteer world?
Due to the COVID-19 situation, we didn't have our planned meeting for the last 3 months. Chief and I have talked. We've decided that we'll plan one for July, and if the commission is meeting in person for July, then we'll meet in person, and if not, we'll try to do some kind of virtual meeting with the volunteer members and see how that goes.
Our tentative plan is to have a traditional meeting for our July meeting. What that's going to mean, we're still working out. If we want to restructure the room for full social distancing or what that means, but we are going to try to do that because if you remember, we were going to try to get a family picture of the whole department that night. So keep our fingers crossed, keep your fingers crossed that we can meet traditionally in July.
We're not too worried about the social distancing aspect because in the bingo hall down there, we can probably give about 500 square feet to everybody who attends.
Have your crews seen any increase in expenses because they have to change their masks so often, or is that just a wash?
We've seen an uptake in use, but on the other hand, due to resupply difficulties and stuff, we've been reusing them to some extent. I know I ended up using one for 3 shifts till it started to delaminate on me, so that was the end of that. But as long as we're not, you know, stuffed in a situation where it obviously is contaminated, they tend to get reused. But we have been used, you know, there's obviously an uptick in PPE use, just because if you get dispatched to a, you know, universal precautions advised or something like that, you pull out the mask, you pull out the glasses, you pull out the gown, and go full bore on that. Plus isolate, like the fireside does, you know, only one person goes in until we determine the extent, and then, you know, the other person tends to minimize their exposure, so as we don't contaminate the cab of the vehicle and things like that.
But, wonderful.
Interestingly enough, initially our call volume dropped off to about 40 or 50% of normal, and it was interesting that the people we were picking up were genuinely sick people. It was almost like all the folks that thought we were a cabulance decided to take a vacation, and we were actually transporting genuinely sick people to the hospital for the most part. But then our call volume dropped way down too. The transport side of the house saw a significant reduction also. Now that we've kind of got back to normal, or more normal-ish, the transport side has picked up as the hospital has started resuming more normal operations. We did have a little uptick as they've started moving people out of York Hospital over to the rehab hospital in preparation for the expected upsurge in COVID patients that really didn't materialize too badly. And then kind of a backflush when they started bringing people back a little bit. But that's kind of evened out. And overall, the transport business is staying fairly steady. Our 911 service, at least at Grantley, has picked up. Is at least the MICU is approaching more normal levels. First couple of times that I was on during the initial part there, our call volume went down to 2 or 3 on a 24-hour period. Now it's more like 5, 6, or 7, maybe 8 during a 24-hour period, which is more normal. And we're starting to see our friends that, you know, I stubbed my toe, I need an ambulance ride to the hospital, those folks again. So,
well, thank you. Thank you, Paul. Any questions for Paul? Charles or George, any new news on the pension review evaluation?
Well, I'm happy to take that for you, Mr. Chairman. About a month ago, as Elizabeth mentioned at the last pension board meeting, she had just sent out what was her take at the revision to our investment policy. And I and George and Lester had the opportunity to go through that document. We met last week for the discussions, and the outgrowth of that discussion was that I had sent to Elizabeth a 5-point email of some various points, questions, asked for clarifications, but the heart of the discussion really centered on the investment mix that Fulton was proposing with regard to equities, and it was a unanimous opinion of the subcommittee that Fulton really was going pretty aggressive, certainly in the range of equities, upwards as high as 88% of your investment mix could be equities. And we all thought that was a bit too rich. So we've gone back to Fulton to challenge them with a couple different mixes, maybe with a little bit more of a realistic limit on equities. Also looking at that 6.5% and 6% discount rate that even Krista was mentioning relative to the actuarial assumptions. So we expect more feedback. Elizabeth did get back to me. They are looking at something. I was asking her to have something so that I could come back next month, again, have it vetted by our subcommittee and to really get the final input and reaction to it. But if you want any of the details, I can go through. Some of it was just some clarity points, I think, and only some minor typos. But like I say, the mix of investments was the biggest area of concern. So we have a little bit more work to do as a subcommittee. I really thank Lester and George for their engagement in it, and happy to answer any other questions.
I don't know. I think it's the first time I ever focused on it. And I'm scrolling through Krista's draft audit report. Our actuarial assumptions assume a 3% inflation rate and a 5% wage increase, as well as the 6.5% return. As you know, all three of those numbers fit into the actuarial assumption. And I'm just wondering, is that 3% inflation rate based on anything other than at one point somebody stuck in 3%, or does that fluctuate with reality?
Well, I mean, I can't answer specifically to any past actuarial assumptions relative to inflation, but historically, I think we've been running around 2% inflation annually, and that's kind of been the Federal Reserve's peg for inflation. But, you know, 2% annually, that compounds over time. So certainly 3% is probably more conservative of an inflation rate. My concern is that given all of this fiscal stimulus and Federal Reserve intervention, we could see higher inflation in a few years. And that's one of the very questions that I posed back to Elizabeth as we built this portfolio. Do we have to anticipate greater inflation? Because mm-hmm. that may very well be coming, not maybe this year, but in a few years.
That was page 28 where I saw those numbers. That's the first I'd seen those. Excellent. Well, it sounds like we have three very inquisitive minds on the project. Thank you for your report. In your packet this evening were the minutes from last month's meeting. Any questions, comments, corrections? Hearing none, I'll entertain a motion to approve them as submitted.
I'll make a motion that we accept them as is.
Thank you.
I'll second.
Moved and seconded. Jean, if you would.
Okay. All right, Mr. Hunt?
Yes.
Mr. Rooney?
Yes.
Mrs. Winger?
Aye.
Mr. Worcester?
Aye.
Mr. Inch? Okay. Mr. Dvorak?
Aye.
Okay, that motion is carried.
Thank you. Old business, we need to review and possibly award the contract for the website redesign.
Yes. I sent an email to the commission yesterday. Hopefully everyone had a chance to take a look at it. That basically summarized the four quotes that we received from our RFP. Three of them, as you saw, actually addressed every requirement that we put in the advertisement, as far as using WordPress, as far as migration of existing information and so on. There was only one bidder that did not specify the WordPress platform anywhere in their quote. And they're listed there as well. And I also included the fees that they proposed charging us. Needless to say, we had the one of $10,800 was the high quote. His work is quite impressive, but I think it's far more than what we need. Based on the bids that we received, staff reviewing them since Friday, we're making a recommendation to remain with Affinigent. Of the three that met the requirements of the quote, they're the least expensive. We have a relationship with them, and as I indicated in my email, both
the company Momentum and Affinigent had the, in our opinion, had the most creative, the most unique websites as far as us looking to improve ours. Everything else is largely just cookie cutter. We had one bidder that gave me four different references, and as I clicked on each one, it literally was the exact same website with just a different name on it. So that's the recommendation we're making to the commission.
And if you questions? Could, if you could remind us what you're trying to accomplish with the upgrade.
Well, we're trying to, first of all, get onto a more user-friendly and a more secure platform. I don't necessarily speak the IT language, but we are currently on a DNN platform that historically has had some security vulnerabilities. In fact, we were hacked last year. Nothing was done to the website, but somebody actually was able to break through the security. So we're looking at securing the website down, making it a lot more user friendly, a lot more easier to navigate, and just be able to find the information a lot more readily. And the other part of it too is the WordPress platform, as I'm understanding, makes it much easier for us as the end user to maintain and make changes. Whereas the current platform does require us, if we want to change something, a lot of times to contact the host, and then that runs into a fee for their time to get things updated.
Steve, you started to say something?
Yeah, and I just wanted to make one comment, just so it's on the record, Gene, that the lowest bidder who's being recommended by staff, Mr. Bishop, is a principal of that company. He is an alternate member on behalf of Spring Experience with the Public Employees Ethics Act. We did ensure that this was a bid that was publicly advertised, and as a result of it being publicly advertised, for which all members of the public had an equal opportunity to bid and be awarded, that we can bid as well as award this to Affinigent, given the fact that it's above the $500 threshold limit, which is the safe harbor.
Thank you.
Yep.
Any other questions from the board to help us zero in on a decision? Hearing none, I'll entertain a motion to make a proposal or to accept the proposal.
I would make a motion to recommend awarding the new website development to Affinigent at a base cost of zero with $565 annually for hosting the website.
Second.
Moved and seconded. Gene, if you would, please.
Okay. Mr. Hunt?
Yes.
Mr. Rooney?
Yes.
Mrs. Wingert?
Aye.
Mr. Worcester?
Aye.
Mr. Inch? Mr. Dvoriak?
Aye.
Okay, motion's carried.
Or should I have abstained because I use the internet too? No? Next on our agenda, you saw a presentation or a recommendation for a schedule of budget meetings. Chief, did you intend for August 6th to be 7 a.m. or p.m.?
That was actually open for discussion. Historically, we've done one typically in the morning hours, but we can absolutely change that to a p.m.
I just wanted to make sure. As you know, I'm awake. Any thoughts, discussions? As I understand it, July 6th, July 23rd, and 30th is staff only. August 6th at 6 or 7 o'clock will be the commissioners. It will be a public meeting, but open to the commission, or all the commissioners will be expected to be there. Is that correct? Encouraged to be there?
Sure.
But what was your intention?
It's always, it's never been a required meeting. Honestly,
it won't affect our pay. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. basically that's an opportunity. And again, it's open to the public, but that's an opportunity to, come in and just have an extra chance to look at what, Lisa and I have done and see if there's any questions they can get answered or any suggestions for us before we get to the more formal presentation at the August meeting.
So then the August meeting is our traditional meeting, but with that, at that meeting, our goal is for the commission to accept the draft and forward it on for review at the townships, and then we will formally present it to the townships publicly on the September 15th, which is the subsequent public meeting. Any questions or thoughts on those dates?
Nope.
They will be advertised. I guess the public meetings will be advertised. So I guess other than that, do we vote on that? Do we need to vote on that?
I don't know. And it looks
you
like
dropped
we lost
off again.
I was going to say, it looks like we lost Steve again. I think it was just acknowledged that they were to be posted unless there was any changes.
Yeah, I think the only new public meeting would be the August 6th one.
And actually, that's not new. We've done that before.
Did you already advertise it for this year?
Not for this year, we haven't, but in previous years, that's been a public meeting too.
Okay. Hearing no dissenting comments, your schedule looks good.
Okay. Very good.
Then your last item on the agenda, the chief presented an option, a well-thought-out letter on fire department billing proposal. Chief, if you want to walk through that.
Sure. Essentially, we understand that everybody's budget-minded when we're dealing with taxpayer dollars. And you know, in addition to the grant money, we're always on the lookout to some way that we can maybe lessen the burden on the townships. Several months ago, I attended a PA career chiefs meeting in which the topic of insurance billing for fire department responses was discussed. And I was actually surprised to find out that there are a number of career and combination departments as well as volunteer departments throughout the Commonwealth that do bill for their response. And the billing is
something different, yeah.
The billing is not related to the type of not necessarily the type of incident or the severity of the incident, but the company that we've been talking to, Pennsylvania Fire Recovery, as you see in my letter there, been doing this for quite a while. They have developed a billing schedule that encompasses hourly rates for fire engines, ladder trucks, rescue squads, even some apparatus that we don't have, as well as the use of tools and equipment. I had contacted some people that I personally knew that were using this company. Nothing but great things to say about them. The chief from Scranton indicated that they've been so so consistent with the revenues that they get from this billing that he actually now makes it part of his projected income on his annual budget. They've helped the city of Reading on two major incidents recover in excess of six figures. One of them was finalized last year. One of them still outstanding. One of my big concerns when I spoke to this gentleman was that I understand that you know, most insurance policies, whether it's a vehicular policy or whether it's a homeowner's policy, allows for expenses related to the fire department response. But one of the things I was pretty adamant about was that unlike an ambulance bill, where if the insurance doesn't pay or doesn't pay in full, you know, it's up to the patient to cover the rest of the cost. I was pretty adamant that I didn't think that we would want to be doing that. From a fire perspective, those are our own citizens. Mr. Hunt and I had a conversation prior to the meeting, and you know, a lot of the accidents we have going through 30 and 83, you know, that's a transient population that is coming through, different demographic. But from a fire standpoint, I didn't want to see our citizens just went through pretty devastating event, also get hit up with, hey, your insurance company didn't pay, so here's what you owe the fire department. I didn't think that was good customer service, and it definitely doesn't seem to me to be good PR. I think there's an opportunity here for us to probably get some revenue generated, at least get to cover the costs of our equipment and our apparatus covered. And Mr. Hunt asked me before the meeting to just run some numbers to give you an example. I think I put in my letter here one of the estimates that the company did for us based on our 18 and 19 call volume. He gave me an estimate of about $150,000 to $200,000. Now, obviously, that's an ideal situation where every insurance company's paying. But just to give you an idea per call, based on our responses, a typical building fire in any of the three townships, they would probably bill in excess of $18,000 to the insurance company based on the cost per engine, based on the cost per truck, use of SCBA, use of hose, use of salvage covers, hand tools, and fire police for traffic and crowd control. From the standpoint of motor vehicle accidents, depending on whether it was a single engine with just for debris, could be as little as $820 up to an entrapment call, which could be as high as $5,800. Now, again, that's what they're billing. That's not necessarily what they're getting. But I think it's something that I've struggled with a little bit because it does kind of fly in the face of what I always thought the fire service was supposed to be. But by the same token, I also understand we need to find ways to generate monies wherever we can. And this might be a way for us to do it and not be holding a hand out to our citizens. So that's pretty much where I'm at. I can answer any questions you might have with anything I said or anything that you read in my proposal.
So if I could just
it's a great idea.
Push out a little bit more philosophically when Dan and I talked about it, philosophically it's as a resident, as a tax-paying resident of the Offer region, I believe that I'm getting fire protection as part of my real estate tax as a resident or through just through through participating in the community, through the mercantile tax, whatever. So personally, I'm uncomfortable with billing residents, which a house fire would be a resident, or a building fire would be a business that is paying tax in our area. I'm more open to expanding our revenue, getting revenue from non-taxpaying people who are using our roads, et cetera. People driving through 83, Manchester's, a large percentage of their calls are vehicle calls on the 83 corridor, which just statistically are probably not Manchester residents.
And we could set it up that way too. We could set it up, to the best of my understanding, we can set it up and say, hey, we're only going to bill these vehicular incidents. And those are the reports that we would forward to him for processing. In fact, Manchester, I'm probably going back, I don't know, five, six years or more. They actually did have an arrangement where they were billing for motor vehicle accidents years ago. At the time, and I don't know if it was because the information wasn't getting processed properly, or if it was the company they were through, they weren't really seeing a whole lot of revenue out of that, and it kind of faded away. I think we'd have a better chance of doing that with this company.
Let me turn the question around to the actual township board members here. As a township representative, do you feel that the taxpayer dollars that you're collecting and giving to Yoffer should pay for the services, or do you think the individual user should contribute to that? You understand my question?
Yes.
If we need more money, should we raise the taxes a little bit to everybody, or should we pinpoint it on
to the user,
who's specifically using it?
I think the answer to that question can be a little bit more complicated. I think it really depends. In a sense, you could be looking at the taxes that the taxpayers pay is that to establish the facilities, establish the fire protection service, establish the equipment and so forth. And then the overall, whenever there is a call, that there should be some compensation for that particular call, particularly if it is a non-resident. But going back to that point, I did want to ask Solicitor Havas, if we could level that sort of discrimination against those which are non-residents, vehicle accidents versus outside residents.
Yeah, I was going to chime in. I was sort of letting the discussion play out. Although there's no case law out there specific to this issue, there is the general proposition that a governmental agency must uniformly apply its rules and regulations. The question is there a reasonable distinction between those services being provided to residents versus those being a traffic accident on I-83 or Route 30 or whatever? There is no definitive guidance, but I think you raise a very good point as to the uniformity of application of this policy.
Well, and I know the words you chose were kind of off the cuff, but we are offering the same level of service. I mean, we won't hold back on, we won't slow down going to a vehicle accident if the guy has Maryland plates. It's the same level of service, mm-hmm. or just billing for it. But I don't want to try to parse your words too closely.
Well, it's sort of like telling our police only ticket people with Maryland license plates, don't ticket people with Pennsylvania license plates. It's the uniformity of enforcement in a sense. We're only going to charge people that are out of staters or whatever.
Yeah, and I don't think we want to cut it down like that. What I'm suggesting is, based on Mr. Hunt's comments, is if we say, hey, we're not going to bill for fire calls, but we're going to have PA Fire Recovery bill for all the vehicle accidents that we respond to. Yes, on 83, that's liable to be a mix of people from the area and not. But when it's a crash at Market and Finley, it's pretty good bet it's going to be somebody local.
Right, and that's
so we're only parsing out the type of call and not the type of right. people that are involved.
And let me. It gets back to my original comments about a reasonable right. distinction. And is that a reasonable distinction? It's one that we can hang our hat on. I just don't know how it would play out at the end of the day.
Right.
I think if you're going to do it, you have to do it over the entire population, whether they're in-state, out-of-state, who knows where they're from.
Yeah.
And you've got to think about it this way, too. We don't charge. A lot of states charge a fire tax in addition to their county tax. Is that not true, Chief?
Well, there's municipalities in Pennsylvania and within York County that have a fire tax.
Spring Garden has an active fire tax.
Yeah, Spring Garden has a fire tax.
And Spring and Spring has one that I believe is zero, but they do have it on the books.
Okay.
A lot of there's a number of townships that they just kind of include that fire tax in. It's there, but it's not listed separately, so to speak.
Hey, I'm in favor of whatever you want to do, Chief. I will promote, I have no problem with what you set up, the parameters. I'm fine with that because I've sort of been heartbroken about this for the last, 15 years on our board about collecting for all these accidents. A lot of them end up being tractor trailer accidents, and you get all kinds of cleanup repair. And I think we need to be reimbursed for that. But to be personally honest, I've been talking about that for a long time.
I have one comment and one question. The comment is that in Spransbury Township, we have various recreational programs and we charge one fee to residents, but we charge a higher fee to non-residents. So we do have a distinction that we use, right or wrong. We do distinguish between what residents pay and what non-residents pay. The question I have, Chief, we've talked in the past about mutual aid calls. Would this fee that this company assesses, would we be able to apply that to mutual aid calls that are outside our Yalfer footprint, so to speak?
We didn't even have that discussion. I can't really answer that at this point. The only thing we talked about was billing the insurance company for the homeowner's insurance or the vehicle insurance. And since we corrected the numbers here last year, they've been consistent that we get help more than we give help. So obviously the fire police, they run everywhere. They pay their own bills. It's not coming out of our budget, but from the career staff, we get help more than we give it. And I think if we go down that road, somebody could turn it around on us as well.
Order of magnitude, George, from Chief's, monthly stats, there were 1,094 incidents that were no aid either way, given or received, and looks like about 150, 73 were aid given, 85 aid received. So if we further refined it to just activity within the offer area serviced by us, it would still be a huge majority of our incidents. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Steve, just to help my brain on what George mentioned, is there any correlation between their two-tiered recreation fee and what we're suggesting here?
I think it's, once again, does that distinction, is that reasonable? And does the court say, yeah, the, as you noted, the underlying resident pays taxes to the township where an out-of-township person does not, and therefore, is that a reasonable distinction? It could be defined as that. I get Chief's distinction is we're doing it on call versus anything else. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think if we go down this road, I think having at least the basis for why we distinguish between a vehicle call versus a house call would be supportive of whatever conclusion we reach or distinction we make.
Well, and one of the things to keep in mind here, too, and based on those numbers that I ran before the meeting, a house fire, structure fire, obviously is going to be a bigger bill, if you will, a bigger invoice for an insurance company because the amount of time you're on scene, in, you know, more manpower, more resources. However, there's not a lot of consumables used at a house fire. You know, the hose we put, you know, yes, we use water, but the hose we put back on the apparatus, you know, and we, not a lot of consumables. Whereas when you get out onto a vehicle accident, you know, you've got, medical PPE that has to be replaced. You have oil dry that has to be replaced. A lot of times in a entrapment type call, your cribbing gets oil soaked or gasoline soaked that might need replaced. So the vehicle accidents, although they're not a much higher rate of incidents, but also a lower chance for or a lower invoice, I would say, it would make more sense from that standpoint because increased number of consumables used.
I like that distinction, Chief, on that consumable aspect. I think that is something that we could probably grasp upon in making that distinction.
Okay.
Chief, I do have one question on your memo here on, I guess it's page 2.B, where they talk about a 44.5% collection rate and the average amount collected about 1,043. What's our current collection rate right now? Is that zero?
Yeah, we're not doing anything to recover any costs at this point.
Or you could say it's 100% collection of zero.
Either way, you cut the math at $0 in.
Yeah.
So I guess what I would like to see is maybe a proposed schedule where you identify the type of incidents, what we would seek the insurance reimbursement for, kind of along the lines of defining the consumables like Attorney Hava said, and maybe project out using this kind of point B to what sort of revenue we might expect based on a typical call volume. I'd be curious to see that analysis.
Again, the data that I gave him to give us that estimate was total call volume, fires, vehicle accidents, and everything. So we would have to go back and take a look real quick. If you don't mind, I can share this with you and just give you an idea of. I just deleted it. Okay. Sorry. I did have the billing schedule all ready to show you what they're talking about as far as per apparatus and per equipment, but I accidentally deleted that. But I can absolutely have that together, and like I said, we're under no time constraints here. I can have that together, and we can continue the discussion next month if that's acceptable.
Yeah, Charles hit it on the head. Let's kind of flesh out, Chief, if you could flesh out a policy to kind of, not kind of, flesh out a policy that brackets the type of incidents we want to bill for, mm-hmm. and if you could do some sort of revenue estimation of that policy based on history. I think that's a great next step. That's a wonderful suggestion, Charles.
Good deal. I can have that done.
Okay. Anything else for the good of the cause? Thank you all for attending. We'll be adjourned. See you all in a month, if not before.
See ya.
See ya. Bye.